Thank you. So thanks for joining me today. So I'm talking to Linda Joy Myers, and I found out about you. I was doing some research, and actually Beth Baraney told me about your work. And so she personally recommended you. And I went to your website, and there's a couple of websites because you have the National Association of Memoir Writers and then your own, and then you work with Brooke Warner. So I'm particularly interested in talking to you about memoir today. The summit is Write Your Story and Heal Your Life. And I am a big proponent of once you begin to write your story and delve into it, that something transformational happens. And I also believe that it can be incredibly healing. You know, it's not like it's an overnight, oh, I'm healed if there's any trauma in your childhood, which many people have. But that the process starts, and I think we start to unlayer and unpack as we write our story. So I was wondering if you could speak to that, because also you have a background, you're a writer and also a psychotherapist, I believe. Yeah. So you're definitely very qualified. And also you've written a memoirs and yeah. So you can I speak to that. Your personal journey, I would love to hear that, and I know the viewers would as well.
So you want to know how I got started writing memoir, teaching memoir, all of that?
All of that, it
Okay.
was very informative, yeah.
Well, I always tell people I got started writing memoir in a way when I was 8 years old, and I was in a feather bed with my great grandmother, Blanche. She was 80, I was 8, and she started telling me the stories of her life from being a pioneer woman, essentially a pioneer woman in the middle of the 19th century, in Iowa. And she started talking to me just as we were going to go to sleep, you know, about what it was like, the baking the bread every day and, you know, the wood cook stove fire, the neighbor women who helped birth each other's babies, the hard work. And she also told me a story that just galvanized me. So it's a big part of my newer memoir, this story that she told me. So she told me she got married on New Year's Day, 1894. And that 2 months later, her husband died. And he was the father of my grandmother who was raising me. So I was like, wow. And then she went on and told me more stories, which I won't go into right now, but just, you know, telling me these stories about worlds and times in the past that I didn't know existed. And I looked down at her, and the moonlight was coming in, the lights had been off. She'd put her teeth in a jar by the bed. And I went, oh my gosh, she's a walking storybook. And then I looked at all these other adults the next day, and I realized that each of them were a walking, each was a walking storybook, if you can only get them to tell you the story. So that started my need and interest to know what happened in the past and to realize that she was living with it. She also went on to tell me that my grandmother left my mother as a little girl. I knew my mother had left me behind when I was 4, and I knew those women fought and yelled and screamed and threw dishes at each other. So Blanche had that story and why she thought it was like that. And so then I was sort of hooked to always try to understand, well, what happened that helped people act this way and feel this way and do these things? So fast forward a little bit. Then I, of course, was a reader and, you know, kind of marinated myself in books and reading. And it was a safe harbor for a lot of things that were going on in my life. But I wanted to be a journalism major in college, but I wasn't allowed to because I had grown up with music. I had a music scholarship and all that. So I, you know, finally, when I got to writing many years later in my late 40s, early 50s, I felt like I was coming to a place I'd always wanted to go to. So I became a therapist when I was 4 or 5 years old, something like that. And the feeling of why I became a therapist was the same as why I wanted to know what happened to everybody in my family. And that is, if I can understand and listen to people, as I had been listened to by then, I'd been in therapy for a while and it was changing my life. Then if I can offer that, then and empathize and draw upon the pain of abandonment and loss and rejection, there's a whole list of things, but I can use that pain for the good of others. And so that made the pain I'd gone through have some kind of meaning or usefulness. Otherwise, it's just like, why did all this stuff have to happen, you know? So then I became a therapist. And of course, it's all about listening and drawing out people's stories and doing all that clinical work. But I had a vision that one day I would write, and I began writing the story of my mother and grandmother and all that in novelized form. But I also decided I needed to get a degree in creative writing. So I already had a degree in music and art and psychology, but going to school to me is just one of the funnest things you can possibly do. So I went to Mills College and realized after a while that I had a memoir on my hands. And in those days, people weren't doing memoir. That was for famous people. Mm-hmm. That was before the memoir breakout of Mary Carr and Tobias Wolff and people like that, which happened just a few years later, not that long. But I thought, well, someday maybe I can combine writing with healing. But there was no James Pennebaker, which we can talk about later. There was no research that I knew of. The only thing close to something that would honor what I was trying to do was the National Association for Poetry Therapy. So I joined them and began to go into conferences, and I met Kay Adams, who's now a good friend of mine, but she has the Journal Center for Journal Therapy and other things. And so these people were talking that language of healing and words and poetry, which I started writing poetry before I started writing prose anyway. And then the research came about around writing as healing, which you may want to talk about in another segment. I don't know. So through that time, I was trying to write my own memoir and really had to wrestle with an enormously nasty inner critic. A lot of abused people have a really bad inner critic, and I was one of them. And I couldn't even write for a long time, actually. I had to go through all kinds of machinations. And so it did take me about 12 years to write that first memoir. And also, I didn't know how to write a book. It seemed incredibly overwhelming. And why did I want to do this? I don't want to do this. So I would run away from the book. I would run away from the story. And it seemed like it would chase me and tap me on the shoulder and demand my attention. So finally, one day, I turned around. I was in my living room with the house I'm in now. And I turned around and I said, okay, fine, I'll write you. Then will you leave me alone? Well, of course it didn't. But then, you know, somehow we surrender into the thing that we have to do. So that's kind of the summary of up to when I first started, finished my new memoir, Don't Call Me Mother. But about 5 years after getting my degree at Mills, when I found out about the Writing as Healing studies, I started offering trainings to therapists so they could use writing with their clients, and I called it Autobiography and Therapeutic Healing. So I did a lot of that for help people get their CEU units until they could all get them online, at which point nobody wanted to come to a live workshop that much. And I started my own private memoir groups that were about writing, healing, being seen, supported, witnessed, and did that for, about 15 years. And then I've done some other things since then. So it's always been part of what I'm doing, what I think is important.
Thank you for sharing. And there was a few really important and poignant pieces that you shared. And starting with your great grandmother, you know, Blanche, and you were 8 years old and listening to her stories. And it reminded me of the stories that my grandmother would tell me. You know, she was, there were four children, and then her mother died in childbirth. So around 1907, her mother died. Mm. And her father and her uncles ran pubs. And the story was that her father, my great-grandfather, got together with what we call the barmaid, after her mother died. And I suppose they had no interest in raising the children. Mm. So they basically farmed them out as orphans.
Wow.
My grandmother basically was sold as an indentured servant.
Whoa, what a heritage.
Yeah. And so just unpacking those stories of, and unpacking intergenerational trauma. So how we inherit that. And I will actually be interviewing Mark Wyckoffler next week. Thanks to you. You introduced us and reading about his work. And it's so important that we have an awareness around intergenerational trauma. So going back to you and your story, and you said, you know, it took you the first memoir 12 years to write. And what came into my mind, that it's not necessarily procrastination. There is that is the long process of writing your first memoir. But personally, I know that when I come to my memoir writing, there is so much in there and so much trauma that there's just days I don't want to write it. Like you spoke about sort of trying to leave it behind, but then it's tapping you on the shoulder. Mm-hmm. And that's part of that we need to write our stories. So many people, they tell me their story, you know, in a nutshell. And I always respond, you need to write your story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that too, of course, all the time with people who are afraid like I was, you know, or the shame. There's often a lot of shame attached, obviously, to people with very tough and dark stories. But, you know, I developed a technique called weaving the dark and the light as a way to help people not get too lost in the darkness, and also to help them find the light, whether it's enlightenment or happier stories or a moment that gave them hope, whatever it might be, as part of the core exercises that we do in these courses. I mean, I taught people what I didn't know but learned myself as I wrote my memoir. You know, I did a lot of it. I took classes and stuff, but really when it comes down to it, finally, I just didn't want feedback from other people. I just needed to trust my own voice and trust my own struggle that I would solve these things. Eventually I had a coach who read the later drafts, and that was very helpful. But really in the end, you have to get out your own pick and shovel and go down in the archaeological dig, I call it, and dig around.
Well, it really is like that, you know, which, as you said, that sort of, I'm a visual person, what jumped into my mind is, you know, the archaeological dig, you know, you're digging down, for the ancestors. You're digging down, you know, literally the skeletons and the cupboard. And it made me also think about Maria Gimbutas, who was an archaeologist, and she was very much sort of studying women's history and mythology, and they found in certain places in the world, like Chateau Hayek, which is the oldest civilization they found in the world, that in the houses they excavated, the skeletons of the ancestors, well, the bodies of the ancestors were buried in the houses mm-hmm. that people were living. You know, so you put the people that you loved underneath there.
But we know we can't escape them anyway.
Exactly. So that, you know, instead of going, okay, they're not there, they're literally. And I also think, though, as you were saying, sort of, you know, how can, if we, you know, we have a past, of course, we have a history, we have a childhood, whether it was the happiest childhood or not, but how do we excavate that? And so much can be through your memoir writing. Mm-hmm. And also you mentioned having a coach at the end, and I'm very much about people having coaches, because I absolutely agree with you. At the very end of the day, it's like you're doing, you know, the brick and mortar. You're actually writing this story. No one else can write the story, mm-hmm. you know, unless you have a ghostwriter. But really, you know, it's coming from you. And often I find it's almost like channeling, you know, even though we know the story, there's this sort of channeling going on. Mm-hmm. But I have a writing coach, and it helps on so many levels. It's the accountability.
Yeah.
And also, I spoke with her yesterday, and we just went through some scenes. I think that maybe some people, if it's their first time writing a memoir, that they might not necessarily think of it as scenes, you know, like, okay, in a novel we have a scene. But they're the scenes of, like, the pivotal moments mm-hmm. in your life. Like, what changed? For example, mm-hmm. you said that your mom basically left when you were four.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pivotal moment.
Yep.
That happened.
I know. I started the first memoir with it.
No, I haven't read your memoir yet. I've heard some mm-hmm. of your memoir, because I've heard Brooke read some. And it's beautiful writing. It's beautiful writing, because I remember Brooke, when she read it, it was in one of your trainings that, you know, people don't necessarily want to hear, for example, when I was four, my mom left.
Oh, right.
Instead of, you know, that, I'm just making this up, but that, you know, when I was four, I woke up in the morning and I realized my mom was gone, and that, you know, the weather, you know, it was cold in the room, or, you know, just
the setting, the scene, the whole thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's what I really heard in your writing mm-hmm. when Brooke, and it was enough for me to, you know, make a note, like, I want to read that memoir. I want to read your memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, again, these stories are so important. And as you said, it's, you know, our ancestors, you know, our grandparents, our great grandparents are, when they're alive, they're these living stories. But I always say, when someone passes away, often what happens, we really lose their stories. Mm-hmm. So how can we write these stories before we lose them? How do we capture this whole history? As you were mentioning, you know, your grandmother sort of homesteading. And then, you know, and then 2 months after she married, her husband died. Mm-hmm. I think it's very hard for us to understand. And anything, if something hasn't happened to us, how do we understand it? But
this is where research comes in.
Right, right. And tell us a bit more about research.
Okay. So my new memoir, Song of the Plains, is very much based on 40 years, actually, of research, because that 8-year-old girl, more than that, but we won't count every moment, that 8-year-old girl went ahead and went, I need to find out as much as I can. So I'm not going to count the childhood questions and moments that I tried to listen in on people's conversations so I could get more. But ever since I was in my 30s. I mean, I knew about a three generational pattern in my family since I was 8. You know, the whole thing, talking about trauma now and the biological, the epigenetic research. But I mean, I was a witness while I also lived the three generational story. So I always knew, well, this is weird. This is not the way it's supposed to be. This is not the way most other families are, you know. So, but in my 30s, 40s and onward, I tramped around cemeteries and found the grave sites of people that were in the family. I did original research first because 30 years ago, Ancestry.com did not exist. I went to courthouses and took down gigantic, huge volumes filled with names and found the wedding certificate of Blanche and Lewis in 1894 on New Year's Day. And as I looked at the signature, I went, oh, they had no idea what was coming. I fully suspect that Lewis, who was all of 21 years old, died not knowing he was a father. I did a lot of research of place. My new book is very much about how place shapes us and also the comfort of being in the beauty of a landscape of the earth. And so I would go and stand and walk in these places. I would walk where I felt my great-great-grandmother, I knew where they lived. I mean, this was a town in Iowa. I would go and walk there. And, so I did research that gave me sensual details. Here's the wind. Here's the river. Here's the smells. This is what it smells and feels like in this place. And so it's in both books, but I really ramped it up a lot in the new book, Song of the Plains. I also, had photographs and then I want to tell you this piece of the story because you were already talking about channeling things in a way. So in the mid 90s, after visiting Iowa, maybe doing some of this research, I'm not quite sure now when I ended up writing these things. But I ended up receiving a cadences of a story as if delivered from an omniscient narrator just in the, like in heaven or the sky or something, about the movements of people through America and how our family fit in with that. And it had sort of a biblical intonation to it. And I was like, well, what's this? Anyway, I just took dictation, wrote it down. And then it was based on a therapy process I did once years before, but I got into the point of view of my grandmother who was raising me. She was born in 1894 and she, lived through an era before World War I, during World War I, during World War II. I mean, she lived in another era. But I knew her very well, and there were things that she said, like, didn't want to be one of those hard-working pioneer Iowa women who got old at the age of 30. I wanted a different life. And she did go off and create that different life. But I also had photographs of her as a beautiful, innocent girl. And later in her life, my grandmother became very difficult. She was mentally ill. She was very abusive. I mean, so there was some stuff that I'd spent years, thousands of dollars, you know, to heal. And it all helped, you know, to find compassion and forgiveness for her. But it's a multi-layered process. There's not just a single moment where you go, okay, forgiven, it's all fine. No, it took a long time. But by going and stepping into her shoes, literally, and walking through her life, through her point of view, through parts of her life, I went, oh, she was this woman. She had a dream. She wanted to do different things. She made a big sacrifice. She left my mother behind. You were not supposed to do that. But I don't, you know, that's what she did. And she... later, I find out what she ended up doing after in her life, but I didn't know 25, 30 years ago. I also did the same thing for my mother. I got the photographs out. I looked at the pictures. I also had a very complicated relationship with my mother. But I wrote from her point of view, a little girl who was, I didn't know how old she was until 2 years ago exactly when she was left. I didn't know. I had to research it for 40 years to find out what happened to her and when. But I knew she was lonely like I had been. I knew that she waited for her mother to come like I did. So I could write from her point of view pretty easily as I imagine it. And that was all good, and I didn't know what to do with this writing, so I put it aside, and I let it be. And then as I was writing this new memoir, my view was, I want to see the large view of our family and our story, and I need to, now that I've done all this therapeutic work and written the first memoir, I'm going to walk in their shoes. And then I went, oh, wait a minute. I did some of that writing, you know, years and years ago. I wonder if it's even any good. I looked at it and went, well, this is kind of good, you know, huh, wow. So I edited some, but it was very authentic from the heart being with these women as young women, including Blanche. I even had there's one piece about her birth, as I imagine it, in 1873. How babies were born then, how little children were treated by German parents who kept a horsewhip in the kitchen, you know. So there was hints of other issues going on there. And so I wove that with this larger view now of us being part of the land, part of, you know, how we're formed by this dirt and the grit of life, and also we can, if we are lucky or work at it or both, have a peaceful resolution ultimately. And I'm much older than I was when I first started Don't Call Me Mother, and I've been working on resolving things all these years, you know. And so this memoir is kind of a love song to the generations and to the Great Plains where I came from.
That's beautiful. A love song. I love, you know, that invokes so much. And the studies, I feel also back this up, but often it doesn't matter how much we may have been abused really in our families when it's, you know, a blood parent that, and they abandon us or whatever has happened, you know, we were beaten, that there's still this love. Mm-hmm. There's this love that really just doesn't dissipate.
Well, but I want to add, though, the studies also talk about, there's a thing called traumatic bonding. And so it's like when the social workers come and get a child to take them away from their mother who has been beating them and burning them and doing horrible things, and the child is crying and crying and crying and reaching out for the mother. It's a little more complicated than love, because the trauma bonds in a strange way, so that you end up with a very deeply ambivalent thing, kind of like love, but need and loss all rolled up into one that you can't even put words to, yeah, usually at first. And so in this work, gradually, as people can feel freer to be invited to find words without criticism, without any kind of pressure, with an invitation also to write from the body, which I think is helpful and important, then some of these pictures and some of these moments can come out, because the children that find a life better than their parents can feel very guilty about that. Yeah. This whole traumatic bonding thing is a piece that needs to be healed, whatever it's called, but
yeah,
the mixed up complicated story, we could call it that. It needs to come out in all the different ways it can, which will then help the person who was the child to go, oh, well, love, fear, hate, need, yes, all of that and more, you know.
Yes, and thank you for mentioning the traumatic bonding or the trauma bond, because whether you're aware of that or not, if you had that as a child and you have been in psychotherapy or you haven't, but that's never been mentioned. I think what people don't necessarily know is how we can continue to repeat that as an adult. And we have trauma bonds in our adult relationships.
Yeah, right. Totally. That's very upsetting, but very true. And I tried to talk more about that because I'm writing this in this new book, I'm an adult, and it's very hard to write. I mean, it's one thing to write about yourself as an abused child. It's another thing to write about yourself as an adult and the things that you end up doing, unfortunately, much of it, as you deal with the inherited trauma that you've unconsciously, you know, got in your body and your soul. So in this book, I take us all the way to this breakdown that I had that led me into therapy, which was the thing that would save me. But I didn't know how bad it was until I kind of went, oh my God, I really am repeating the patterns. I always said I would never do it. Yeah. And I am already, which was that okay, that's it. You gotta go for some help. And in the 70s, things were more open about therapy and there were more therapies available, but it was still something that most of us had been raised to think is for crazy people. Yeah. And if there was one thing that terrified me, it was to be as crazy as my mother and grandmother. It was like, no way. So to even get close to that was like a hot fire that I would turn away from, but realizing I was repeating, and I knew nothing. I was not a therapist. I was an artist. I didn't know anything about anything, but my body told me to go get help. Body, soul, whatever else was helping me in that moment, something whispered strongly, a voice came to me. I went, okay, all right. I knew that voice was important.
It's yes, and as you're saying that, I'm really thinking about the wounded healer in terms of how you have taken this to, you know, being wounded, and now you're healing. You're helping people on that path through your psychotherapy practice, but also through your writing and your writing as working as a writing coach and holding space. You said earlier in the interview, sort of really helping to pull these stories out of people. And when I'm a writing coach, I also have a women's writing class. And then people who don't know what I do ask me what I do. And I start with, oh, well, I teach writing. And then I say, no, actually, I don't teach writing. I said, what I'm really good at doing is holding space and holding a safe space for people to write and to write their stories. Mm-hmm. So sort of helping to draw those stories out of people. And I think the very first place to start is to create that safe container that you're there and I'm not going to judge you if you've been sexually abused. I'm not going to judge you if you were beaten by your parents. I'm not going to judge you if you sometimes have anger, which is often very natural if things have happened to you as a child. So on that note, I'd love to talk to you about some of the things that you do in writing, because you have Journey of the Memoir, the three stages of memoir writing. And also write your memoir in 6 months, which you teach with Brooke. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to know more about that, and I'm sure our viewers would as well.
Well, so what do you want to, I mean, one's a book and one's a program, so is there any particular angle you want to know more about?
Well, it would be great, I think, to know more about the book, because mm-hmm. I think that will really inspire viewers to know more about it and, you know, jump on that boat of like, this is a book that I'd like to have, you know, by my bedside table as a reference book while I'm writing my memoir. And also write your memoir in 6 months. I think great for people to know more about that, especially as people are on this journey.
Okay. So, but I do want to make, I want to talk about first though my book, The Power of Memoir, because it's a book that, it's called The Power of Memoir, How to Write Your Healing Story, since this is all about healing.
Yes.
So in there, I go more deeply. In Journey of Memoir, it's about the stages of writing a memoir and finding out what stage you're in and how to go through them. The details of how to go through them emotionally and psychologically through writing are in The Power of Memoir. So I just want to mention that. And that's where I talk about the writing as healing studies and also issues that come up around your family, how to deal with your family, how to write anyway in spite of what the family might be saying to you, which I think comes in the early stage that I talk about in Journey of Memoir. The early stage is, dare I write my story and where do I start? How do I tell the truth? What are my truths? How do I write them and tell them, even though right over here the family in my head is chattering away or shaming me? Now, some people, and I talk about the inner critic and the outer critics, and all this is in this early stage because we have to have some kind of freedom to be able to move forward and have three stages of writing and not just one, you know. So I call the family what they might actually already be saying to you, the outer critics. And we always teach this in our Write Your Memoir in 6 Month course too. The outer critics are people who really are saying, if people said to me, oh God, aren't you over that yet? What? You're still doing all that writing? You know, well, when is your book going to be published? Or what do you mean you're writing a book? You know, I mean, all these things are sufficient to shut you up and send you back unless you're really, really clear on how to manage these things. So in the early stages of Journey and in the early part of The Power of Memoir, it's about permission and some of the things we've already discussed. And I teach this technique in everywhere across the board in all these years. Turning points. Find your significant turning points because we usually have so many memories. We're overwhelmed. Or we want to write this and this and this and this and this. And you're going to have a 100,000 word book if you do that. And you might even get overwhelmed. So these turning points are moments where your life changed or something significant happened. And you can actually build the spine of a structure with turning points. So then the middle stage in Journey and in any writing process is the long middle stage. We often, Brooke and I call it the muddy middle. Everyone recognizes this who's ever done any writing, even an essay. You can get to the middle of a muddy middle of an essay and go, now what was I saying and why was I writing it? You know, it doesn't even have to just be a book. But that's where a deeper level of psychological archaeology may show up. We talk about the labyrinth, how you end up going in here and oops, no, I need to go back. Oh, no, whoops, well, wait. Okay, you know, and you try to make your way through this labyrinth into this core part of yourself that's guarded, yes, by minotaurs and monsters and scary things. But when you go, you confront those fears, which we all have in various degrees, then you're in the heart of your own heart, you know, and you may be in darkness, but as a therapist, I teach this, but also as a writing coach, really the way out is through. You have to go through the darkness to get to the light. But we also, as a coach, I'm sure you do this too, we don't want people to like die in there, you know. We want to give them some tools to get out enough that they can go back in. And, you know, you may have to go in and out there for a while, but realize that the writing will free you. It won't kill you. It won't.
I love that. The writing will free you.
You feel like it will, but it will free you. So this whole set of surprises happens, I think, in the middle. where you are lost in the darkness, you get glimmers of light, you write your way through it, and all the research on writing is healing says, write the dark stories only for 20 minutes at a time. Dr. Pennebaker talks about this. We're doing a conference May 19th. John Evans talks about this, where you take care of that vulnerable part of you by having briefer sessions of the darker stories. We have some cautionary tales in our six-month class when people, I mean, they needed to tell their story so much that so much had built up that they just kind of blam, dropped in all the way down and fell hard. And so we really try to help people not do that by saying you could do that, but if we're your coaches, we're going to keep an eye on you so that if we think you're getting lost in there, we're going to bring you back out and you can, well, it's a mutual understood thing. So there's all that. And the middle is the longest stage. It's really half. Let's say it's four. It's really more than three stages. The middle stage is long, so you could divide it into quarter, two quarters, and one quarter. The last stage is getting your work published and out in the world, doing editing and revising. I have so many students, though, that talk about, oh, revising, oh, no, oh, editing, oh, no. And I teach revising means revisioning. It means seeing again. It means, man, you do not have to get all this stuff out of you. Now it's down on the page. Now you can have fun. You can paint pictures with your words. You can get rid of those extra adverbs. You can find a bunch of great verbs and nouns in your thesaurus. You know, have fun. You know, I love revision because the artist part of you now is free to come out. And also the part that learned from writing that whole thing all the way to that stage and finding some kind of ending. It may not be the ending you end up with or the beginning you started with, but then you have this, it's out in the world and you can work with it. And I just think it's so amazingly, wonderfully creative that way. So that's the essence of. And then in the six-month class, I do want to say that we teach craft, and I want to integrate the writing as healing with craft here for a second, because what happens is when you write a scene and you drop into the now of then, let's say you're 9 years old, and there's the wind and the dirt and the scene and the smoke in the living room and the two people fighting, which is what I write about sometimes, or a beautiful moment where someone notices you and says, oh, you're a beautiful child. And you go, huh? Oh, that's nice. You know, and you put that in your pocket and take it with you. But you're the I character. You are in the scene as a character, as yourself. You're also the I narrator. You're saying, well, and then after that day, I always went back to that teacher hoping for some more breadcrumbs, you know, whatever it is that happens. So you're narrating and guiding and weaving with the I narrator. And so what I thought of one day is I thought, wow, this is like the observing ego we talk about in therapy. The observing ego is like your narrator. You're watching, noticing, naming, etc. And the I who's living in the scene is feeling with all the sensual details. And that is what makes the story come alive, is this interaction between the two, the tension between the two, as well as the way both are needed. And so in the six-month class, we teach all the techniques, flashback and moving through time and scene and narration and dialogue and characterization, all those things that give you the craft to make your story really rich and full.
And that's so important, as you're saying. Tell me and the viewers how you teach that class. Is that online as well as in person if people aren't local?
It's all online. I mean, they can live down the street and we do the class online. So it's people sign up and it's every other week that we teach. We teach an A and a B group because we always have so many people signed up. It's great. And we have a syllabus on writeyourmemoirin6months.com so everybody can see what we're doing when for each class, what we're covering. And so we do it through a webinar and we have slides and we take people through both the points we want to teach, and we use lots and lots and lots of examples from other memoirists, well-known memoirists who do writing, famous memoirists like Danny Shapiro and Mary Carr and Frank McCourt and other, and Helen McDonald, who wrote H is for Hawk. We also do some sideline teaching where we teach a 4-week class of the New York Times bestsellers. And in there, we delve into those particular books. But we bring all that teaching back into the 6-month class because we go deep in that teaching. And then we just say, hey, there's this amazing passage in Wild or whatever. And we, and show people how different writers are going to do everything differently and yet deliver the power of the story.
That sounds, I mentioned to Brooke, I just said, that sounds so wonderful that I want to do it. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of, you know, always with me, like everyone, sort of carving out the time. And I'm also a big believer if you really want to do something, you know, you find the time and you earn the money. So, it, you know, I'm looking at the structure. I'd like to ask you, I read H for Hawk, and it was, there was, you know, one thing I got out of it as a reader, because I grew up in England.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
So it was sort of...
How much of England is in that book, boy?
So much of England. And, you know, just even the... when she found out... Well, I don't want to give too much away when if people haven't read the memoir, but let's say when, you know, someone really important in her life dies. And never thinking of this, sort of, you know, how he'd parked his car in London. You know, and they walked around and round and round and round for days, and then realizing, oh, it's probably been towed. But just things like that that you don't necessarily think about, you know, when someone passes. But I'd like to know your thoughts on why you felt that was a bestseller.
Well, let me say this. Helen herself, we saw her here when she came, and she didn't, they had very small expectations of this odd little book about this woman who is grief-stricken training her hawk. I mean, it's in the back cover that her father dies and that she's healing her grief, so I don't think you're giving much away. But this whole, so you go, well, training a hawk, how weird. However, Helen is just an amazing writer that, and we teach some of what, I mean, I'd love to read from it even, but we teach the detail in which she slows down and writes moments. Here's a moment, here's a moment, here's a moment. And we are with her in the moment, in the setting, in the landscape. There's so much landscape of Britain and the history of Britain through its landscape is in there. It inspired me a lot with Song of the Plains because I've always thought that way. Therefore, that's one reason I liked her book, because we are participating in history in ways we don't even know when we're walking through a field.
Exactly.
And she captures that. And of course, England has a much longer history than, and she goes into hundreds of years of history, but not in a boring way, in a way that in this moment, in the now, you're also in 1598, you know, when such and such happened. And yes. I just thought that was great.
That's what I really enjoyed. One of the things that I really enjoyed about that, because I did not appreciate the history of Britain when I lived there, only because you just take it for granted.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're on a bus in London, you know, and I like to sit on the top, on the double deckers, and I just look, you know, you look out the window and go, why is there a wall just there? Like, that's so incongruent. And you're like, oh, that's part of the Roman wall. That's right there. And it has to stay.
Still there. They don't tear things down there.
No, they're pretty good, you know, and they're always talking of excavating. You know, that they have to excavate everything before there's a new build. And recently I saw something on PBS. It's just a little sideline, but it's also, you know, if you are writing history, either in your memoir or you're working on a novel, a historical novel, which I am, part of it is set in London. But this documentary showed that during the plague, when, you know, they're burying hundreds of thousands of people. That I always thought, because my primary school was opposite a park, but we actually knew that it was a plague pit.
Oh, wow.
And I always had this imagine that they just, you know, threw, you know, so many people were dying every night, just threw the bodies in. But what this recent excavation showed, that the burials and the plague pits, were really sacred ceremonial grounds, that they had the families and the children all laid together, that it was very respectful.
That's good to know. Yeah.
It's good to know, but, you know, just going back, how important it is to
history. Yeah.
And even if it's for a memoir that people might not necessarily think that, you know, you're doing so much research, but it's great to have it in there. Just like Helen MacDonald's memoir, that she does say, you know, these fields and, you know, these hedges have been here for the last like 500 years, and these like 1,000 year old oak trees. And it was just beautiful. And I think what you mentioned is so poignant and made me remember how she does slow down. I mean, she'll write about the breath of her hawk, her goshawk, you know.
And yeah, well, you know, about that history, when I realized I was writing about the history of Iowa, I did a lot of research of the history of the region. And what I found out is that my family came to Iowa from Ohio. I'm one of the earlier people in this family from Ohio as soon as the lands were cleared of the Indians. And so the Sac and the Fox Indians were in that region. And I remember my great grandmother and some of her older friends talking about how when they were young, and this is in the 19th century, the Indians would come to the back door and ask for food. And so I put it in, you know, and how by the Mississippi River they would have fished, they would have hunted in the woods before the lands were cleared. And so, okay, yeah, we got this land as a family where the children were raised and born and all that was there. Now it's empty. There's just a cornfield. I know what was there. But my feeling is that we can, and I think Helen does this, we can try to escape that history. It's not valued that much by Americans enough. But I think the memoir craze, which is now a movement, you know, allows and invites people to honor not only their own family's personal history, but the land and the landscape and the larger history of America, which we have a history. We just need to remember it. We need to honor it and talk about it and allow it to enter our stories, even if it's just a little bit. I mean, I just think it's really a great opportunity. A lot of people don't think about it. It may not always be appropriate, but context matters.
Context matters. And on that note, just, we have a few minutes left. I'm sure that all of these subjects and more are discussed in the National Association of Memoir Writers. Can you speak more about the association?
Well, I will say this about that, how I started it. I want to mention that because I just had this little intuitive idea that I wanted to honor and hold a place for memoir writers. Now, I started it 9 years ago. Well, the web was a much newer place to have things happen 9 years ago, and I didn't know anything. I tell people, I started a business, but all I knew about business, I did therapy with people, and they wrote me a check, and I put it in the bank. That was my business acumen at the time, and not versed in the web or anything. But I took a class based on just an intuitive sense that I wanted to do something different, and it was on how to build an association and create a network, you know. And so I started knowing less than nothing about any of it, but I just felt that it was important and could help people. So it was just one of those things, and it's been a very steep learning curve to the point where I'm falling backwards on my steep learning curve. It's getting easier, of course, by now, but getting guests like you do to come in and speak, experts to come in and speak about all aspects of writing. Writing is healing, craft, all avenues of craft. And then I added a free thing per month called the Roundtable Discussions, where I invite people who've just written a book, who have a program going that they want to talk about. And so people don't have to be members to get a hold of that. And then twice a year I do a memoir summit. In fact, this week we're having one on writing, healing, and transformation. With Mark Wolin, Mark Matusek, John Evans, and myself. Brooke is going to interview me about my book and why I felt it was important to write it. And so many of these summits are free. And then if people become members, they get access to all of our recordings, which are number in the hundreds at this point. And now we're doing webinars. They used to be just phone things, and now we're doing webinars. And so it's been growing. But the a new benefit I added last year that is really fun for me is our group coaching, and it's free for members. And so we all get together on the phone once a month, and everybody announces what they're writing, what their theme is, or their title, and the problem that they're having. And so we have between 10 and 25 people on there every month, getting acquainted with each other, finding a writing buddy that they can send their work to, or accountability buddy. And then they get me, you know, they ask me the questions, and then they help each other. Oh, well, I was writing a memoir like that. Maybe you'd like to try such and such, you know, they say to their colleague. And so that has been really good because everybody gets to talk to each other. And then we have a Facebook group and, you know, all kinds of ways that people can communicate and connect.
It's a really wonderful resource for writers, memoir writers. You're doing such great work in the world. And I don't say that lightly. I say that with going back to the wounded healer that just, you know, we've just had a couple of conversations, but from what I hear, really taking, you know, your life and your life experiences and really how to transform that into, you know, your living, what you're doing for a living, and taking your passion with writing in and supporting and helping writers. And also in your psychotherapy, you know, practice. And I'm, you know, just I'm really honored, you know, to speak with you and to you just share this information, because I really sense, and I'll know more when I've read your memoirs, but so much story there. And some people could, you know, life can be very challenging. You know, life can be very hard and a struggle. And it's how do we, going back to memoir writing, but how can we take our stories and take these experiences that if it can be so challenging, rather than cave underneath them, which...
Well, some of us have already caved, and then we go, well, okay, what can I find in this story, right, which is our truths, our personal truths, our personal lived truths? I mean, the whole memoir movement now is, I have a story that's important for me to tell. And oh goodness, I got all these things out of Cheryl Strayed's story and Frank McCourt's story and, you know, Augustine Burroughs' story, all these different people. There's so many, that help me, they say to themselves, oh, well, maybe my story really could help someone else. And so a lot of the conversation at NAMW and on the web in general about memoir writing and with interviews with memoirists and memoir teachers is these stories are bigger than us.
Absolutely.
And we hook together and we support each other. I think it's a new form of social witnessing. I like to quote Alice Miller in her, she's a well-known, she's dead now, but she wrote a lot about abuse and about how important it is that we have a witness. If we have one, what she calls enlightened witness, we don't suffer as much. Let's say we're a child and there's a teacher who looks at us and goes, oh, you're important. You're amazing. Memoirs are witnesses to lived times. Without writing, like you said earlier at the very beginning, if we don't write them down, they do disappear. And they disappear from the family archives, and they disappear from anyone knowing about it. And we all have something unique that the world needs to hear about. And it isn't, you know, memoirs are accused of narcissism and navel-gazing. I have one friend, she says, well, so what's wrong with navel-gazing anyway? You know, you get to learn a lot about yourself, and then you can share it. I'm like, yeah, I know. But it needs to have a takeaway for the reader, you know, that the reader goes, oh, I'm learning about the theme of grieving, or I'm learning about how you healed, and okay, thanks, I'll take in the parts of that I need, you know, that's what the reader does.
Absolutely. And then there's, you know, the biggest subjects of, you touched on, you know, the history of the plains and the Native Americans who were there before. And when you were sharing about Memoirs, I was actually thinking of James Baldwin, because he took on such a the big subject, which I feel is really something so fundamental for us to look at right now in the history of America, but racism, you know, and how in his personal writing he was conveying so much, you know, what it was like to be a man, an African-American man, but a man with black skin in America.
Well, novels have always been memoirs, not everyone.
Right.
They've always, I mean, had versions of people's real story. And, you know, I think that some people can't write their story as a memoir, and I respect that. And so write it as a novel. Okay. Just be clear about your genre, you know, keep to the rules there. But, but there's a lot of genre bending right now. I don't know how that's all going to turn out, but still, yeah. Mostly, write.
Just write.
Get it down.
Absolutely. You know, write, get it down. And on that note, we're going to be winding up, and we're both writers. We're both coaches. We've both, sounds like, you know, we've had these challenging childhoods, and then how to transform, you know, how do we, I have this sort of saying, like, basically, if you don't like your story, you know, or if your story was challenging, make it right. Like, make it right for you. Mm-hmm. And using the W for the right. Like, we can write it.
Yeah. And,
but on that note, as we close, I was wondering, we didn't discuss whether you have a free gift to offer for our viewers.
Oh, yes, I do. Can I send that to you?
Yes, absolutely.
And I forget which one it is, but we do these big telesummit conferences, and we have something that I think I can send you, and we'll figure it out. But yes, I'll be glad to do that, because, you know, I think people need all the support they can get. And thank you for inviting me and having this beautiful interview with me.
Thank you. I really appreciate your time. I know that you have you're doing a lot, as we spoke about. So I really appreciate the interview, and I'll be in touch, and I'll be, I will actually be filming more summits in the future. I'd love to interview you again. It's such a wealth of information.
We could go down one of those avenues and go deeper if you want.
Yes, absolutely. So
how much, Laura?
Thank you. Take good care. Bye.